It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a guest says we can make ourselves happier by harnessing the power of our personal data. Learn how to hack our happiness.
First, voucher schools are on the rise around the country. They began here in Wisconsin in the early 90s and have since taken off elsewhere and are currently being considered in many more states. The voucher system allows public funding to go to private schools.
While these schools may get taxpayer money, state and federal departments of education don't necessarily have a say over what's taught in the classrooms of these schools.
The result is that as the number of voucher schools increases, so does the amount of public money going to fund schools that teach concepts like creationism and intelligent design, things generally not taught in public schools.
Politico reported on this trend today. Senior education reporter Stephanie Simon is here with us now to tell us about it. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
So it sounds like, in the midst of a boom in voucher schools. How big is the growth? Why is it growing so fast?
Well, the number of students who are attending schools on some type of voucher, who are attending private schools on some type of voucher or tax credit scholarship, is up about 30% just in the past few years. It's at 250,000 nationwide. So that's still just a small fraction of the total number of public school students in the U.S., but more and more states are considering these vouchers and these tax credit scholarships, and they're sort of a popular way for politicians to offer more choice to parents and give them more of a say of where their tax dollars are going.
I know that it varies some from state to state, but in general, how does public funding for these schools work?
Well, there's a couple different approaches. So you can have a straight voucher approach where the parents can apply for a voucher from the state that helps them pay tuition at a private school, and that comes directly out of the state treasury. Or you can have what's called a tax credit program, which is where individuals and corporations are encouraged to donate to nonprofits that then provide scholarships for students who are eligible for the vouchers. And in return for those donations, they get a substantial tax break. In many cases, they get 100% of their donation back on their taxes. So if you're an individual with a $2,000 state liability, you donate $2,000 to the scholarship organization, you wipe out your tax liability, and you may even make money because you can also claim that donation on your federal taxes and get a credit for that.
When the state or the federal government provide funding, do they keep say over the curriculum at these schools?
No, almost no say. And you're having a debate right now in Wisconsin over what kind of accountability measures should be in place for schools that accept vouchers. But in most states, students who accept these vouchers are not required to take the same tests as public school students, and the government doesn't retain a say over the curriculum. So the schools can teach what they want as long as they meet certain health and safety guidelines that the state sets.
So you found that in a lot of these schools, creationism or intelligent design are being taught, things that usually wouldn't be taught in public schools. How widespread is that?
Well, not only wouldn't they be taught, they're not supposed to be taught at all in public schools. That we've had decades of litigation on that question, and the courts have come down very firmly that public schools are not supposed to teach creationism or intelligent design because those are viewed as religious theories rather than academic theories. And so, but the private schools are free to do that, and there are hundreds of schools all over the country that receive public subsidies that do teach creationism. And what this story on Politico explains is that it's not just a matter of teaching during, one unit in biology class that God created the earth in 6 days. It's a creationist philosophy that goes across the whole curriculum and that encourages students to really distrust and seek to rebut all kinds of mainstream scientific views and even mainstream mathematical concepts like set theory. And it's a view that extends, from kindergarten through 12th grade across all subjects.
Objecting to math theories, why is that?
Well, there's a popular set of textbooks that doesn't include modern concepts like set theory because they hold that God established the laws of mathematics and we should stick with the ones that, in their view, are old and traditional and not fluid at all. And they don't like concepts like set theory that allow for sets of numbers to be self-contradictory and have different characteristics that, in their view, contradict the scriptural way of looking at numbers.
And supporters of vouchers being used this way say, hey, what's being taught in public schools is contrary to my values as a parent. Shouldn't it be my right to have the choice to send my kid to a school that teaches values we agree with?
Exactly. And they say, and they point out that, you know, they're paying taxes too to support public schools that are teaching things they disagree with. So turnabout is fair play, and people should be okay with funding their kids going to schools that teach values that they believe in. And as to the debate about how accountable they should be, whether kids should take the same kind of tests, supporters of vouchers generally say, you know, the school should be accountable to the parents, and presumably if they're giving kids a bad education or an inadequate education, parents will stop sending their children to those schools. So that's sort of the only check and balance that they want to see there.
Are we seeing pushback to the teaching of things like creationism and the other things you've mentioned in these schools?
Yes, it's a concern for people who are opposed to vouchers. So in a lot of states, for example, just in Florida, there was a huge battle just over the past few weeks over a plan to greatly extend and expand the voucher program there. They have a built-in escalator, so already without any changes in law, they're going to be vastly increasing the amount of money they spend on vouchers to send kids to private school, but proponents wanted to increase it even more. And creationism was one of the concerns that opponents raised, and they ended up winning and getting that further acceleration of the program killed just last week. So it is an issue that's coming up here and there in different states, and I think it'll be more prominent. Right now we have more than two dozen states right now considering expanding or enacting new voucher programs. And so this is going to be an issue that comes up in those debates as well, I'm sure.
That case, that issue you mentioned was in Florida. That was legislative. Are there court challenges to taxpayer funding of these schools that teach creationism and other things that have already been rejected in the courts for public schools?
Well, on the federal level, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that it's perfectly legal for tax money to flow to the private schools that teach creationism or religious schools in general, so long as the vouchers first go to parents. So parents, the money isn't going direct into the private school. It goes to the parents who then have to turn over the check to the private school. So the Supreme Court has said that's okay from a federal constitutional level, but from a state constitutional level, certain states have provisions that are much stricter than the federal constitution on this matter. So right now there's litigation going on in New Hampshire and Colorado and Alabama. The New Hampshire one, actually, the court's going to be hearing arguments on that in a couple of weeks, and that's contesting precisely this question of whether tax money can go to religious schools.
What's been the reaction from the scientific community or the science education community to these findings that more schools are using public money for this?
Well, you know, they're appalled and they're very concerned that students aren't getting the grounding in basic facts about the age of the Earth, the age of the universe, and the process by which, you know, humans came to be here, the long sweep of evolution over 4 billion years. And they're also concerned about the anti-science type views that are nurtured through these type of curriculums. And as I said earlier, it goes beyond just teaching this is the story of how we came to be here. They're really, if you look at the school websites, as I did, and if you look at their course syllabuses and textbooks and workbooks, threaded throughout it is just this sense that we can't trust the secular world, we can't trust modern discoveries. And that really disturbs science educators because they fear that, you know, the kids who learn this will carry that through in their life and be not only skeptical but hostile to mainstream science and mainstream views.
A lot of the impetus behind voucher schools and other alternatives to public schools has been, hey, we need competition because the public schools aren't always as high quality as we'd like them to be. The competition will boost that. Are parents seeking out these alternatives more for quality or more for some of the religious reasons you've been talking about?
Well, really, it's both. I mean, there were two fascinating studies in the past 6 months from the Friedman Foundation, which supports vouchers, and they asked parents receiving vouchers in Georgia and in Indiana what their reasons were for seeking out a private school and getting the state subsidies. And in both cases, better academics was virtually tied with religious education as the top reason for parents in Georgia, and better education was just a few percentage points over religious education in Indiana and way ahead of other topics, like other possible reasons like smaller classes, safer school, better discipline, those were all largely secondary to the idea that they would have better academics and also a stronger religious education that reflected their values.
Stephanie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Stephanie Simon, senior education reporter for Politico. Her report on the public funding of religious education through the voucher system came out today.
In today's internet age, we tend to leave a digital trail of breadcrumbs wherever we go. Whether we're tweeting about what we had for lunch, reading an article on a news website, or using an app to map out a morning run, we're amassing personal data that marketers and other groups can't wait to get their hands on.
And while that digital trail isn't going away anytime soon, our next guest says we can take back that data for ourselves and start putting it to work. And by doing so, we can use it to better understand ourselves, our lives, and increase our overall happiness.
Joining us now is John Havens. He's the founder of the Happathon Project and a contributing writer for Mashable and The Guardian. His new book is called Hacking Happiness, Why Your Personal Data Counts and How Tracking It Can Change the World. John, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
At the beginning of this book, you write about how you had a revelation about this idea of our digital entities, identities, and what they mean. Could you talk about what happened and how you first got started thinking about this?
Sure. My dad had passed away, and I found myself, like most people when you're sort of examining grief and thinking about loss, sort of saying, how can I take a measure of my life? And in my case, I wanted to take it literally and track my actions digitally. And when I started to do that, I realized that my data, how it's being used and managed by others, was a huge part of my identity. And that became a real purpose for starting the nonprofit that I did, the Happathon Project, and writing this book.
Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of just how much digital data we're generating right now and where all of it is coming from?
It's easiest just to say ubiquitous and all the time, in the sense that a lot of people think their digital data is mainly about their computer when they knowingly enter in data, say, to subscribe to a service. Then people also are aware of, say, their mobile phones, and they get the idea that their GPS data is also now with them when they walk around. But now with something called the Internet of Things, which basically just means sensors like RFID chips or surveillance cameras, essentially data is being tracked about us anywhere we go, whether or not you're on Facebook or even have a mobile phone.
And you write that we're kind of just at the very beginning of this huge technology boom that sooner or later it's going to happen, that we're in line at a coffee shop and people will be wearing altered reality vision wear, kind of like Google Glass, and they'll be able to see our Facebook data floating above our head.
Yeah, I actually think, I'm a big geek, so I'll just say that. But I love studying this stuff, and I do think whether it's 5 years or 10 years, it's essentially, definitely going to happen that these tools will be something that people will want to use. I mean, for myself, I don't know about the two of you, but I remember 10 years ago railing against the idea of using a cell phone. I remember telling my brother, I said, this is so rude. I would never use this. And 10 years later, it's almost fused to my body. So although people say like glass or even something called augmented reality contact lenses is something they wouldn't wear, when you think about a hands-free phone or a computer over your eyes, a lot of people will adopt it because they want to have their hands free to, drink their coffee while they walk along.
When you're thinking about all of this, you've used the word quantified self. Can you define that?
Sure. Quantified self is actually a term and an organization created by a guy named Gary Wolf of Wired magazine fame. And the basic logic is that you track your life using data to optimize your life. So you could actually use a pen and paper, or a friend of mine jokes about having a pair of fat pants, the pants that you put on and you've gained some weight because they're really tight. Basically, it just means you're quantifying your life. You know that you want to lose some weight. So when you're able to track or take a measure of your life on an ongoing basis, you simply have data to know how to optimize your life.
So we can use this data to optimize our lives. On the other hand, right now, all of that data, it's not really coming to us. It's going to other parties. And I think as internet users, a lot of us are aware of it, but we just sort of feel helpless about it. I mean, the options right now, you can opt out, which doesn't seem very feasible in today's world. And so how do we even start to navigate those waters, start to use it to foster well-being when we have no control over it?
Well, there's a new nascent industry, what's called the personal cloud industry. And people are probably familiar with, like, uploading data to, say, their Amazon cloud or they may even use something called Dropbox, which is where you can store large files in the cloud, you know, sort of not on your computer. That same logic, these personal cloud, or sometimes they're called personal data banks, this is now a real evolving industry around the world. It's actually grown faster in Europe and the States, where people's PII, or what's called their personally identifiable information, data, can actually be housed in this bank sort of format. And what that means is now in the future, we're hoping, or I'm hoping in the book, this is what I talk about, that people can sort of store their most essential, what's called the golden copy of their data. And then with any transaction, whether it's online, mobile, as they walk along, they can automate how they want their data and identity to be shared with the world.
So you are the owner of that personal data?
Correct.
And you could use it maybe to broker a monetary transaction, or you could use it in the ways that you write about, ways that sort of enrich your life. Can you talk about what that would be like, to use this data that's out there to make your life better?
Sure. I mean, the quantified self movement right now, there's so many great apps and wearable technologies, things like Fitbits, where the data that we have, some people are, you know, using the term big data. A lot of people with health data call it their little data. This wonderfully intimate information we've never been able to see before, it's now revealed. Things like, what does the sine wave data from my voice look like when I'm angry versus sad? And if I can timestamp that throughout the day and throughout the week, I can start to get a visual picture of sort of a mood diary. And you can start to see, who am I with? Where am I when these different moods happen? And you start to gain insights about the places you're going that maybe aren't the best place to go to optimize your well-being. And then in terms of the data lockers, first of all that wonderful intimate information about your identity, I'm not trying to tell people how to share it. I would just love them to have the opportunity to make that decision for themselves. And then it also enables things like new, actually, economic structures, where people with a sharing economy, I talk about it in the book, like at a Starbucks, if someone wants to take your picture at a Starbucks, they can say, hey, can I, you know, pay you X amount of money to take your picture, because your face will be tagged when it goes up on Facebook. This type of data bank or personal data cloud will allow that type of transaction.
So is that something that you can do now here in America? Can you own your own personal data on the cloud?
Well, there's a number of great companies. I interviewed a guy named Shane Green, who's CEO of Personal.com. I'm also part of the Hapathon Project, as part of what's called Respect Network, which is a group of personal cloud providers around the world. So I would definitely advise listeners to check these out. Personal, for instance, also has a great thing. I think it's called Fillit, where you enter in that golden copy of your data once, and then if you go to any website, you don't have to re-enter in your sign-in information 7,000 times. It does it for you. So it sort of gets you in the habit of seeing, this golden copy of my data is so precious, I should be the person to decide how it's managed and used.
Because right now, what happens to that data when it goes out there? Where does it go?
It depends on, you know, who you're signing in with, and most places have these Byzantine, you know, 48-page-long privacy agreements. That's for a particular purpose. They want to get people, you know, focused on the sort of ennui about hating to, you know, go through all that. You just say, yes, take my data. What people don't realize is that data can be used multiple times and sold or given away to multiple parties. It's not like when you hand a dollar bill to someone to buy something. That data can be copied, you know, a million times. And in the States, right now we're at a time where data brokers, companies like Axiom, et cetera, have been sanctioned by the FTC because right now those data brokers don't have to give copies of the data collected about us to us, even if we ask. So I think there's a great opportunity to have transparency and innovation, where companies don't have to not have that data. They just have to have a better relationship with their users to say, this is how we want to use that data. Do you feel comfortable with that usage?
Can you tell us about the Hapathon Project? What is that?
Sure. It's a nonprofit foundation I started. Our tagline is connecting happiness to action. And we have surveys, and we're using mobile tools like the ones right now that are gathering things about, say, your marketing preferences. We want to have, instead of all these great and glorious tools, be used just to track, you know, your purchases. We want to help people increase a sense of purpose. And by doing that, the survey that we have right now, it's at hapathon.com/survey, and it's free, by the way. In a protected data environment, people know exactly how we're using their data, which is for research purposes. People track their values for 2 weeks, meaning for every day for 2 weeks in a quantified self way. They look back on their day and they reflect, did I live to these values each day? because a lot of research shows that if you don't live to your values, your happiness decreases. And after they do that, after 2 weeks, then we send them back information and insights showing where they may not be living to their values. So the logic there is by that tracking, you're taking an action that can actually literally increase your happiness. So we're doing that and also global workshops around the world.
John, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to John Havens, the author of Hacking Happiness, Why Your Personal Data Counts and How Tracking It Can Change the World.
We'll talk about something that's hard for a lot of people, saying no. Research shows that turning people down can be so difficult that people will even agree to unethical requests just to avoid saying no.
Elizabeth Bernstein wrote about saying no in her latest column. She writes the Bonds column for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Why is it so hard for people to say no?
Well, you, in a nutshell, we want to get along. We are pleasers, most of us, or at least we want people to like us. It's very important to be part of communities. So it's very hard then to feel like we're rejecting somebody when we say no to them.
And how does not saying no get us into trouble when it comes to our busy work and personal lives?
Well, we're all, as you say, so busy. We're almost overwhelmed. I mean, the kids, two jobs, you know, just everything, the pace of modern life with technology. And so we have requests coming at us from all areas, from our families, from our friends, from bosses, coworkers, and charities. It goes on and on. And so if we don't learn to say no, we'll get nothing done. We really have to protect what's important to us and what we most want to get done. To protect our priorities, we really have to learn to manage them. And doing that is saying no to the ones that are not that important to us.
And I think that the ones who are not that important to us tend to feel bad when we say no. At least that's what it seems like we're worried about, that when we say no to somebody, we're going to hurt their feelings and we're going to damage a relationship no matter what level that relationship is at. Is that true? How damaging is saying no?
Well, it is exactly that. That's what we're worried about, that we are going to hurt someone's feelings. We're going to let them down. You know, it's true, actually. Our brains react more strongly to negative information than they do to positive. So when someone hears a no, they do have a pretty strong reaction just in their brain. Neuroscience shows us that. But at the same time, there's something out there that researchers call the harshness bias. And what this is that we feel others will judge us more than they actually will. We're worried that the, you know, sort of the amount of hurt that we're going to give or the amount of criticism we're going to get is worse than it will actually be. So yes, people will be hurt when we say no, probably, but it won't be as bad. They won't be as devastated as we think they will be.
Well, and that gap is probably where the trouble comes from, the difference between how bad they'll really feel and how bad we expect they'll feel if we say no to whatever the request is.
Exactly. So in that gap is where all the problems happen.
So how do we get around that then? So we know we've got this gap. We know we'll be better off if we learn to say no. How do we take those first steps and start to get more comfortable with it?
Well, it's interesting. I talk to sort of therapists and other experts, psychologists on this, and they say that the number one thing you want to do is plan ahead. So you want to have sort of a no in your back pocket. You want to have a ready-to-use answer for requests of any kind, really, that you don't think you can do. So you want to have it. It should be polite. When you deliver it, it should be gentle. You don't want to just shout out, no, I would never do that. You know, so you want to sort of say, I'm sorry, but I cannot do that. But it also should be definitive, exactly that. You know, I cannot do that. So, you know, those are the big ones. Also, another interesting, important thing to do would be to learn not to say yes on the spot. So maybe you get blindsided, you're at work, coworker asks you, you know, hey, can you drive me home tomorrow, whatever it is, and you can't do it, you need to say, you know what, let me think about that. I'll get back to you. So you don't want to, you want to learn not to say yes just because you're put on the spot and you don't know what else to say.
One of our WPR colleagues has a running joke along these lines. If you ask him to do something, he'll say, no, I have anything else to do at that time. And I assume we need something a little more polite than that.
I have something else to do. There you go. It's just anything will do. I'm not doing what you want.
And in terms of the research on this, there is actual research about people being biased against saying no. Isn't there? People will go to incredible lengths to say yes or to avoid saying no is more the point.
Exactly. People will go to incredible lengths to not have the uncomfortableness of saying no. So researchers do study this. And they also know that if we say a no one time, if we decline a request, we're more likely to say yes the next time, simply because of the guilt of saying no that first time. But researchers study saying no. And in one study that I liked, they asked people, they got a whole bunch of college students to go up to strangers with a library book. The college students had a library book. They asked these strangers to deface the library book by writing the word pickle in it in pen. And they had predicted the students, they'd asked the students, predict how many people do you think will do this? And the students said, oh, about 29% of people will do this. It turned out it was half the people said, oh, okay, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing this, but I'll do it. They'd rather write pickle in a library book than say no and hurt the feelings of a stranger.
Is there a certain personality type that has more trouble with this than others?
There are. You know, anybody who is a pleaser, who, you know, wants to please, there's people who are conflict adverse. They don't like to be in any kind of uncomfortable situation where there's an argument or a conflict. Those people, there are people who just habitually say yes to everything, sort of the so-called doormats who just, you know, never ever step up and say no and protect themselves.
Is there any research on whether it's better in terms of the reaction we have in our brains when we hear no, whether it's better to have someone just say a flat out no or to have someone say yes, but then you keep stringing the other person along, say an office mate who keeps wanting to clean out the office.
Just hypothetically.
Just hypothetically.
And that office mate keeps canceling the cleanup date and week after week goes by and the office never gets cleaned out.
You know, I don't know of any particular research on that, but I did ask psychologists that, and they say that it is better to be upfront. And so where you get yourself into a problem is stringing the other person along, because
uh-huh.
Now you have to basically, if you're saying yes and you really mean no, you're lying, or, you know, you're just at the very best, you're putting off your decision to say no or the uncomfortableness of saying no. And so you're stringing it out, but you also are having to say it over and over. So it's better for both of you to say, look, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to be up for cleaning that office. I'm perfectly good with the mess as it is.
So the takeaway is that Rob is a liar.
Hey, whoa. we can get into
that.
This off air.
Okay.
Operation Cleansing Flame will be a reality at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in our society, Elizabeth, we're often confronted with people who won't take no for an answer, whether it's a friend, a boss, somebody soliciting money on the phone, who their job in some ways is to break down that initial no, or a salesperson. How hard does that make it? How can we inure ourselves to that?
It makes it so much harder. So, yes, a lot of people, it is their job, and they are trained well to make sure that they do not take no for an answer. So moms are among that group, by the way, too. What you need to do is stand firm, and that makes it even harder. So you said no one time, and now you have to say it a bunch more, but you need to learn to do that. So again, the experts will say you stay polite and you say, no, I'm sorry, I can't do that. And no matter how many times that person says, but are you sure you don't really want to buy, you know, these bonds I'm selling, then you keep saying, no, I'm sorry, I don't want to do that. You just have to keep repeating the same thing over and over.
So the same thing over and over, is it important to just use that pattern, something that diffuses or defangs the other person quicker?
Well, because you want to get rid of them, right? You don't want them to keep coming back at you. So you don't want to say, you don't want to put them off. Well, you know, call me next week. But you don't, if you keep varying your excuses, they might be seeing a hole in there. Well, this excuse was this today, and yesterday it was something else. You know, so you just want to, you don't even owe an excuse in many cases. You do if it's someone you're close to or a family member. You know, grandma, I can't come over this weekend. I'm really sorry. You know, the kids are sick. It has to be something specific if you're close to them, but you do not owe failed salespeople an answer on why. You don't owe them an explanation, just no, and you keep repeating it.
In our lives, though, there will be times when it'll be better off for everyone if we say yes. Assuming we take the time after that initial request, don't immediately say yes, how do we start doing that mental triage that, yeah, this is something I can prioritize and know that other thing isn't?
Meaning you, when you want to, when you say yes, but you really wanted to say no?
Or no, how do we figure out when we don't give that initial yes answer, how do we sit back, take a step away, and then make that decision? Yeah, this is something I ought to do.
Well, so that's why, again, you don't want to give an answer right away. So you say, you know, let me sit on that. Let me sleep on that. And then you think about it. And you're right. There are times, many times, really, especially with family or your boss, that you're better off saying yes, even if it's something you didn't want to do or squeezing it in. And so then you really have to think, like, you know, I'm not the only person here that has to be happy with this decision. Will the most amount of people be happier? Will it benefit my family? Will it benefit my job? You know, you want to ask yourself these questions, like what's the upside of doing this? And you may find out that it's not that hard to see that it's something you should do.
We're talking to Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein about how to say no more effectively.
And what about you? Do you have a hard time saying no? Have you ever agreed to something you didn't want to do just because it was easier than saying no? And what strategies do you have? You can call in and share your experiences at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send us email to talk@wpr.org. We're picking up our conversation about the difficulty lots of us have saying no and how to overcome it with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. She tweets at ebernsteinwsj.
And you could join the conversation. Do you have trouble saying no? Are you too busy, constantly overwhelmed because you say yes whenever you're asked to do this or that at work or away from work? Or have you learned how to say no? What's been the benefit of that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@wpr.org.
And Elizabeth, we talked about some of the techniques we can use to learn to say no. One of them is repeating the same words over and over again, or giving yourself space to think about it and maybe building up to that no. What about tone of voice? Does that matter?
It does matter. Being a gentle, sort of calm tone of voice, what happens is I think some of us feel that we just get pushed too far. We're spread thin to begin with. Then someone's coming at us with a request, and we, try to say no, but we really waffle out of it. And, you know, by the time we really decide we need to say no, we're just shouting it out or, you know, snapping and saying, no, I can't. So you want to be gentle and polite, very polite, and just say, look, I wish I could, but I cannot. I am sorry. So, tone does matter a lot.
And how about hedging? Like, well, not this time, but maybe next year, or maybe sometime, but not now.
Well, by doing that, they've got you. So maybe next year, they're coming right back at you next year. So probably charities love this because they just put you right on their list for next year. So, you know, no should be no unless you want them to come back next year. Maybe, you know, you just this year you're done with these requests, but next year you have time. But if you don't want them to come back, forget it. It's like telling a telemarketer, yeah, call me next week. No, you don't want to hear from them next week, so...
Do you have any stories about people who did harness the power of saying no and how it changed their lives?
I did. I have stories of people who learned how they sort of taught themselves how to say no. One woman was, she said she's very petite and sort of had a gentle voice, but she was also a pretty big executive, and people would not really take no, especially she was always asked to sit on charity boards, and they wouldn't necessarily take no for an answer. She felt they didn't take her seriously when she tried to push back. She was spread thin. She was on too many boards. So she said she would stand on her office chair. She would get up on her office chair to make herself feel stronger and taller and bigger, and she would sort of growl no at them. So it did backfire once when her boss walked in, but other than that, I think it worked out okay for her. She even told me her tips on balancing on the swivel chair. She
wow.
said, you put one knee on the desk.
Don't try this at home. Well, Elizabeth, I know people and you have readers, and often when you write things like this, it touches a nerve with a lot of people. Is this one of those? Do you keep hearing from people who say, oh my God, this is my life?
Yeah, I do. People say, wow, like, that's me. You know, not everybody. Of course, there are people who have no trouble at all saying no. It's just their knee-jerk reaction to almost anything. But, you know, most people, a lot of people wrote me and said, you know, this is me. Thank you. I hate letting people down. Or, you know, and what's interesting, too, is there's not research that shows whether men and women are different, but the experts who study it say, anecdotally, they believe that women have a harder time saying no, and that's because women are they're conditioned to be the connectors in society and in their families. They're the ones that have to keep all the relationships going, and so they're really juggling so many more balls in the air, so it's hard to let people down. But men are conditioned to, you know, provide for their families, and so with that goal in mind, and they can, it's very easy for them to say, well, no, this doesn't fit into that goal, so of course I wouldn't do that.
Let's go to the phones right now. We have Marcus with us from Green Bay. Hi, Marcus.
Hello. I recently volunteered to give an older gentleman a ride home from the food pantry with his groceries. One thing led to another, and I was bringing him for rides all over the place. And one day he called me. I was shoveling snow, and I carefully explained to him that I couldn't do it. He wouldn't take no for an answer, and this went on and on and on until finally I wouldn't answer the phone, and there were messages, tons of messages, and finally he sent over the police because he was supposedly concerned. They told me to block the phone, that they know this gentleman, and now I find out he's slandering my name up and down this strip of businesses where I live, blaming me for all his woes. So what, you know, I have a note in my wallet with three sentences explaining that I'm not responsible for him or his personal problems. Mm-hmm. What how should I feel about this? I do feel a bit of anger and yet sympathy.
Gotcha.
Person, so.
Marcus, I want to get Elizabeth in on this. Unfortunate, you know, a good deed done there, but taken advantage of, I guess, and an expectation that he'd keep doing things for a person.
Exactly. This person had an expectation. It's very hard. I can appreciate how you feel, because you probably feel guilty as well. Like, you know, you're somebody who needs help, and you know, but I can't step up all the time. But you're right. Your note in your wallet is correct. You're not responsible for someone else. You did a good deed. If you want to do a good deed again, that's great. Hopefully it will not escalate in the future with someone else. But also, my guess is someone that is that, I mean, I shouldn't say anything bad, but my guess is someone that latches on to you, a stranger, and will not let go, probably has some other problems too, thinking correctly. And so this is not even somebody who sort of has an ability to lead his life pretty well, I'm guessing. So you should all know this person doesn't probably think correctly. It's not my fault. It's not my responsibility to take care of it. And don't let that stop you, though, from trying to do more good deeds.
And we have a caller who couldn't stay on the line who asks, how can a business communicate a change of policy to customers who might not like the new change without losing the customer? So for businesses who, you know, that the old credo, the customer is always right, how do they handle that?
I think you would want to explain it certainly very carefully, why you're doing this, why you have to change whatever the thing is you're changing. But also, if people are upset, listen to them. Listen to them carefully and say, I'm upset. Don't just keep telling them, oh, well, this is good for you, if they feel that it's not. Say, I'm really sorry. I really hear you, but unfortunately, this is the change we had to make. I think sometimes when people feel heard, that's enough. You know, they don't need you to do what they want, as long as they do feel you at least heard them.
We also had a note from Reed in Clintonville who says, when I get a telemarketer on the phone, I engage that person in conversation and ask lots of questions about themselves, where they're from, because they don't want to talk about themselves. They want to make a sale. They get off the phone pretty quickly. So I guess divert and change the subject a little bit to say no.
Totally. Yeah, change all the rules on them. But the problem is, what if you get a chatty one? You'll be on there forever. But that's a good strategy. Might want to try it.
Did you meet anyone who is a super no-sayer and just really went to town with it and employed it all the time? I'm just curious about, you know, whether in general people do say no or say yes too often, and if they really just, you know, the opposite of saying yes all the time, if they say no all the time, they're happier.
I think people who say no all the time, well, I don't know if they're happier. I haven't met somebody, as you said, but I've witnessed it. I've seen people who are very good at this. And I don't know if they're happier, but I do imagine that they have more time for their own priorities and their own things they want to do. So perhaps they really are happier. The only drawback would be, are they making the connections they need to make and sustaining them? If they're making people mad, then they may not be happier, but maybe they're saying no effectively and politely and then going off and doing things that they like to do.
How are you at saying no, Elizabeth? We're glad you say yes when people ask you to come on Midwestern public radio programs. Keep doing that. But apart from important things like that, how are you on this whole yes-no thing?
I am not so good, depending on who it is. So if it's a family member, if it's my mom, if it's a good friend, it's hard for me to say no then. But so I'm learning. That's one reason I needed to write the article.
Are there different cultures that are better at saying no? I wonder sometimes if it's a peculiar American thing that we really want to keep saying yes.
I don't know about research about that, but I would guess that Americans are, have a good day. They're known, sort of around the world for being people who have sort of almost what reads to other cultures as almost like a fake politeness. And so, maybe somewhere in there we say, yes a lot. So I don't really know the answer, but my guess is Americans could use some lessons in saying no.
And I wonder about, habits of highly effective people and success in the business world and that sort of thing. If there's a rivalry in schools of thought between, yeah, say yes, get involved, get things done, you'll impress people, versus no, don't take on too much, focus on what you're doing and do it well.
I think it is. It's a balance that you have to strike. So, because if you're saying yes across the board, this is also the work-family balance. If you're saying, yes to everything, you're not going to be able to prioritize and move forward on the things that are important. So you can't just say yes to everything across your company because your own boss is going to be upset. Why aren't you doing, what my department needs you to do? So it's probably, you're right, it's probably a balance that you really have to work at continuously.
And you talked about women, but if you look at, for instance, Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In campaign, which involves saying yes an awful lot and then some, maybe to get things done, it's just the wrong way to go, leaning in. I don't know. Have you thought about leaning in and saying no?
Well, some of the criticism for leaning in, which, so many people, think is so interesting and good, but I have heard some of the criticism is that, it's nice if you have a big support network. So you can say yes to everything if you've got a staff to help you, nannies and housekeepers and all of these things. But if it's just you, raising your kids, going to work, keeping your family going, and all the other things, wanting to give some money to charity, say, but you can't give it all away. So you do, no matter what, even if you do lean in, you still need to prioritize.
Elizabeth, thanks for joining us. Will you come on again sometime?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, yay.
Good answer.
That was Elizabeth Bernstein, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. We've got a link to her article on saying no on our Central Time Facebook page.